Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Our guest is not. I'm going to keep the music on for a little bit and see if we can get him.
How are things in the great nation?
Well, in the great nation, you know how things are going. You write about it all the time. I tell our listeners we finally hooked up. John Rachel is here, and he is in Japan.
It is 8:03 a.m., and it is Friday morning here. I'm in the future.
Ah, you're in the future. Okay. Well, just have some coffee and think about the real future now. You've been writing about possibilities and things. I wanted to go over a few things. You are such a prolific writer and traveler. Before you left the U.S. in 2006, had you done very much traveling, John?
I had done a little bit. I've been to Israel. I've been to England and France. And also to Australia. And that was about it, really. Oh, I'm sorry, in South America, way back in the 80s, I went to Peru and Colombia.
Okay, you had traveled, maybe not extensively, but you had traveled quite a bit before you took off for 26 countries.
Not as much as I would have liked to, but yes, I did do some traveling, yeah.
Yeah, but now, I mean, in the past few years, you have been just hitting it, and you're writing. I don't know how you really have the time Do you, I think we talked about it before, like you don't have a real schedule. You don't get up at 4 in the morning and write for 3 hours every day or something like
that. Actually, I get up at 6:30 every day, and I do write every day for 3 or 4 hours. So.
Okay, you do. Did you start out to do that kind of a routine, or did you just fall into it?
Well, I've always been a workaholic, and it's probably, it's always resulted in, you know, a lot of productivity. The writing thing, as I probably mentioned in the last show, was kind of a default. I used to be a music producer, and I had a full-blown recording studio.
Right.
And that's kind of hard to fit in a backpack and travel. So, you know, I packed all that stuff up in 2006. I really didn't know what was going to happen. I kept the studio for 3 or 4 years in storage. And then I started traveling. My first year around the world, I did something called WOOFing, which is Worldwide Opportunities in Organic Farming. And because I was really curious about how food grows. You know, I'm a city boy. I thought food just came in plastic packages.
How depressing.
And I also have been very concerned, especially living in California for 15 years and seeing the widespread use of insecticides and all sorts of chemical additives. You know, I was very interested in the whole concept of organic farming and permaculture and so forth. So anyway, I spent my first year doing that and learning how to travel. As an American, I really didn't know how to travel. I never even heard of backpacking. I mean, I know it sounds stupid, but it's true. I was as green and uninformed as a person could possibly be. Did I ever tell you the story about my first night in Madrid?
No.
I mean, you know, picture the classic dumb American walking down the street at 1 a.m. in Madrid. I had just gone dancing because I love dancing, and I had on me my wallet, passport, credit card, and money. Really smart thing to do. So,
well, where else are you going to have it? I mean, when you're traveling, I mean, you've got to have all of that, don't you?
Well, not really, just out, you know, having drinks. You know, I always tell people just carry the bare minimum when you're out. And I could have left it in my room or wherever. There's always a secure place to leave things. I didn't know that then.
Okay.
So I thought, got to have all this stuff with me because that's the safest place. So anyway, I'm walking down the street. And this really wiry young Spanish boy comes up to me, maybe 16, 17, and he starts high-fiving me. Hey, Americano. I don't know. He must have just looked at me and said, no, this is a good American if I've ever seen one. Hey, Americano, I love your country. I love your country. I said, oh, great. I love it, too. So we're just, you know, doing the small talk thing. And then all of a sudden, he throws his leg in front of me, and I almost tripped.
No.
Yeah, no, so, and I thought, wow, that was odd. The next thing I know, and this kid was fast, the next thing I know, he's standing 20 feet in front of me, and he's holding up my wallet. And in my wallet is my passport, my credit card, I only had two credit cards, and my cash. Now, here's what the kid did. This is so unbelievable. He opened the wallet. He took the credit cards out, and he threw them on the pavement in front of him. Then he took my passport, and he threw that on the pavement in front of him. Then he took my wallet, and he threw it on the pavement in front of him. He waved and walked away. He was telling me, you stupid traveler, tourist.
Exactly.
Don't carry all your stuff with you. You're going to get
making a point. Oh, my God.
True story. And that was my first night in my trip around the world. And it was truly the beginning of an education. You know, I learned. I learned where you hide stuff. I learned the countries where you're safe in. I learned the countries where, you know, you have to cling to everything. And I also learned the whole business of traveling. I get traveling the low road. You know, I didn't stay in hotels. I woofed. So that meant I was staying on these farms.
Right.
They give me a room to sleep in, which sometimes I had a lot of roommates, you know, little critters running around.
Right.
Weren't great accommodations. So, and in return, and they fed me, and in return, I gave them 25 hours of my labor. And then the rest of the time, I was free to explore the local community. But the cool thing was, I was actually there. I was living with people, doing real people things. I wasn't in a hotel asking the concierge, you know,
to go see. Yeah, okay.
And then as a part of this process, I met all these, this whole, there's this millions of people, most of them, you know, a third my age, most of them are on something called gap year, which I never heard of.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And, you know, they're traveling the world and they're, you know, they're doing it on $20 a day. And I learned this whole business of backpacking. And I'm telling you, it's a great world. You end up staying in cool places, you meet a lot of interesting people. You really see life on the streets. You don't see it from, like I say, from the, you know, 26th floor
balcony.
Of a hotel.
Yeah.
Plus, it's cheap. You know, I mean, I eat great. I always sleep well. I'm safe. But I'm not staying in luxury places. So that's how I can go to all these countries.
Right. Do you do you go to hostels sometimes, John?
Youth hostels, although that's a misnomer because
I know, yeah.
Guest houses, they're sometimes called. You know, when I travel, I try not to spend more than $20 a day on the basics. That is, you know, food, shelter, a beer, coffee in the morning, whatever, just the basics.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, especially if you go to local restaurants, not only do you actually find out what people eat. You're sitting. There was a restaurant in Saigon I used to eat at almost every day. I was the only white person, Westerner, that ever went in there. They used to giggle when they see me coming because nobody ever went to the restaurant. And I would eat a great meal of rice and tofu and vegetables and soup and tea, all for the outrageous price of 85 cents.
Oh.
This is dinner. 85 cents. I'm not exaggerating.
Oh my goodness. I'm speechless. It's sounding so good. And 85 cents?
85 cents for dinner. And then, you know, sometimes if I had a place to cook, I go to the local markets, you know, and I don't speak the language, so I have to do all this pantomiming and everybody laughs, thinks you're stupid. But, you know, you kind of lose all that self-consciousness when you're in other countries. Because who's going to know that John Rachel is this total clown, you know?
Well, and the people might laugh, but I think they're probably laughing maybe with you more than making fun exactly. Or if they're making fun, it's not in a mean-natured way.
No,
I mean, people are very flattered when you, like you going into the restaurant all the time with no other white people. I mean, they're flattered that you enjoy it enough to come in. And, you know, I mean, we have to get past the, thinking that everybody's out to get us and they hate us because we're American. That kind of thing, you know, it's like, it's not. Also, did you ever couch surf, John?
I actually, before I left America, I joined something called Hospitality Club. My original plan was to do, and which is like couch surfing. There's Hospitality Club and there's couchsurfing.com. They're the two biggies. And there's actually three or four others that are big players in that share your accommodations with people from other countries. And my first plan was, and I actually looked into finding places, was to go to Morocco. I still haven't made it to Morocco, but I really wanted to go there.
Yeah.
And I was going to couch surf. But then I discovered this woofing thing, and I thought, wow, that's intriguing.
Yeah.
And so I woofed in Spain, Switzerland, Italy, Uganda, Kenya, South Africa, and Japan.
Wow, I guess I didn't realize that so many varied countries were offering that. That's great.
you can actually woof in America. You can woof in Hawaii.
Mm.
Believe it or not.
Yeah, well, that would be, yeah. But now, you in Japan, you met this lady and you fell in love. And
it's true.
So you're married now, and when you take off the next time with a backpack, is she going to grab one too, or will she stay home and wait? I mean, that's what she waits for you, but will she stay home or will she go with you?
Well, she's a teacher. She teaches full-time elementary students. She teaches music. She has a wonderful singing voice and plays piano. So she only has certain times during the year where she can actually travel. And we were able, during our 5 or 6 years of courtship, to kind of weave our travels together. So she joined me, for example, when I was in northern India, she joined me there, and we were in Ladakh together for 3 weeks. She joined me in Malaysia. She joined me in Vietnam. So that's how we did it back then. Now, I kind of come and go.
Yeah.
Japanese marriages are interesting. They're very independent. If you look, it's hard to explain. It's not that they're not close.
Mm-hmm.
And ours is of course kind of a hybrid, because I brought my romantic American values with me, which is part of the reason she puts up with me, because if you look at things like housework, 78% of the housework in Japan is done by the female, even working females, whereas in America it's kind of split evenly. So she likes a lot of the things I bring to her. But the Japanese side of our marriage is very independent. She will go to parties alone.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend she's going to a wedding by herself in Tokyo. And the corollary to that is that I do some traveling on my own. I don't know where I'm going this winter, but last winter for 6 weeks I went back to Vietnam and I went to Cambodia, and I sunned myself on the beach, and I worked on my next book. So this year I think I'll probably go to Southeast Asia, and she'll probably join me there somewhere for maybe a week during the holiday break in December. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just stay there, you know.
Sure. Well, I think that sounds, it sounds so much more pragmatic, realistic, this kind of a marriage, because there's nothing quite as smothering as somebody who won't let you out of their sight, who's always up your butt. This way you have your own things that you do. And when you come back together, though, you have a lot to talk about.
A lot. That's true.
And to share, and then, she'll join you on the travels when she can. And, I think that's great. I still have some friends. Well, I have to tell you that a lot of the people I know, the couples, are not splitting housework 50-50, trust me. I have friends who won't go any place without their husband or their boyfriend. It's like,
right.
And sometimes it's the other, sometimes it's the guy. Well, she doesn't like that, so we're not going. And it's like, well, can't you just, go by yourself? I don't see where two people that get married are supposed to all of a sudden not be a whole person anymore. Why they have to become an appendage of another. So the way you guys are doing it, I think that's great.
I really do. Marriage is such an odd institution in these times.
It is.
I've seen something I call the canceling effect with marriages, and it's why old people end up, you see these old people who are married for 40 or 50 years and just kind of stare straight ahead. They never look at each other.
Yeah.
And they're really boring. I hate to be judgmental, but they're really boring. And the reason is the husband used to like flying model airplanes, but his wife doesn't like that, so he gives that up.
Yeah.
And the wife used to take ballet classes, but he thinks that's a waste of money, so she gives that up. So they keep giving things up for one another, and pretty soon there's nothing left. Now, to me, a marriage is the dynamic of a good marriage is all those different things that you do that you then can share and enjoy about each other.
Yes.
But that's kind of the opposite of the model of marriage, the way it's constructed in the West, which is, well, what do we have in common? Well, we like to watch TV together. And they eliminate all the other interesting things, the things that drew them together, the things that were interesting about them as individuals and probably attracted, they eliminate once they, you know, join their lives. And that to me seems the opposite of, if anything, you want to add more interesting things to your life.
My adopted sister and I have, we both at different points in our life, but we found some old Helen Gurley Brown books. If you remember, Helen Gurley Brown was the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine. Forever. And way when she was getting started, she wrote some books. We could ask Janet, but like Sex and the Single Girl and a few of those books. I swear, those lessons we learned as youngsters reading these old books, a lot of them have stayed with us. And one I'll never forget was about maintaining your independence. And she said that, and that this is, you know, just like on a real light level, but it can be carried like deeper. She was saying that, you know, some men would say, oh, you know, I don't want you to wear makeup, or I don't want you to wear those dresses, whatever. And so she said, but yet you go to a party and he's off chasing the woman with the red lips, the red fingernails, the red, you know.
And right. She said, and hoping that guys aren't looking at you.
So. Exactly. And it was like, you know, don't let yourself fall into that. You've got to have some kind of independence. So do what is good for you. And I've never forgotten, you know, when you're a teenager or preteen, the lessons learned then stay with you. for better or for worse. But I find it horrible. Like you were saying, what do people have in common? And, well, they watch TV together. You know, that sounds so boring. That truly is a slit-your-throat kind of situation, I think. But that's me. I mean, I suppose if you're a TV producer or something, that might be something you would have. You're doing it on a whole different level. But I did want to say also that your site is www.jdrachel.com.
Right.
And you have different articles. You've recently written a couple blogs. You write a lot of blogs, and you got quite a bit of play, I think, from This Is War.
Uh-oh. That was a really controversial one, yes.
Yeah. Well, I know people were commenting because you did have a picture with it, and it was an American soldier trying to climb out of a tank. I mean, he was all burned and everything, you know, and it was, but we need to see things like that. And I'm sure you've heard that I've read that the Vietnamese War, the war in Vietnam was televised pretty much. And that was one of the reasons why Americans got so tired of it, and they saw things that were happening and how dreadful it was. But now we really don't do that so much, and people don't see pictures like that you have.
And that's a political choice. I mean, mm-hmm. Bush, you know, barred any photographs of the soldiers returning in the coffins.
Yes.
So you will not see from the Iraq War any of the soldiers being returned to America dead. And that kind of sanitization of war has had a very, very horrible impact on the conscience of America. And I just wrote an article called Conscious Conscience. And
I was going to ask you about that one, too. Yes, that was...
Well,
go ahead.
I was waxing philosophical, you know. I mean, I kind of... I go back and forth between writing, morality plays and the more hard-hitting pieces like This Is War. But I have to say, and I'm as much a victim of this as anybody, is it just baffles me that Americans can be so tolerant and so accepting of the death of, we're not talking about a few thousand, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who don't quite look like the average American, but there are still people. I mean, I lived in Vietnam for 6 months. I know Vietnamese people. They're just like you and I. You know, they speak a little different language,
yeah,
but they have the same basic, you know, your basic goals are what? Have a good life,
exactly.
Have a nice family, have some children, make their life a little better than yours. Have
You're
a
supposed
good
to feed them, not have them running into shelters all the time. I mean, you know, we're all wanting the same things, basically.
Exactly. But we exterminated, and I'm not using that term to be dramatic. We exterminated 840,000 of these people.
Yes.
And I guess what really shocked me, and I met soldiers that fought on the side of the U.S., and I fought soldiers that were fighting on the side of the Viet Cong while I was there. And I guess what astounded, I would expect the Viet Congs to want to, as an American, to want to beat me to death. They were so gracious. They just said, you know, this is something that happened. We want to forget. We want to put behind us.
Yeah.
And yet, we dropped more bombs on Vietnam than all of the bombs dropped on all sides in World War II. I mean, we completely decimated that country.
Yeah.
Now, how can Americans look at that and say, well, you know, you do what you got to do or whatever? How do people rationalize that?
By allowing themselves to be totally dumbed down somehow. And I don't understand it. I don't either. I don't know. And for, like, Americans who supposedly, I mean, and we know there's a lot of people in America who are, unchurched, for want of a better term, but supposedly, you know, there's supposed to be moral, Christian, not just Christian, Jewish, people here in this country, and how they can rationalize all this murder. The Muslim people in this country don't seem to be able to rationalize it quite as well, at least the ones I know, as the Christians and the Jewish ones. But particularly the Christian ones, because I know more of those because I grew up in a Christian church. And
right. What denomination was that?
It was American Baptist.
Wow, okay.
So, yes, I'm not anymore. You can tell that. But the American Baptist isn't quite as strict or closed-minded as the Southern Baptist, I believe. But
okay.
That's
okay.
Me. But it was, yeah. And I wouldn't have, my parents, I think, did a pretty good job on me, and I had a great childhood. So I can't, you know, it wasn't something I stayed with, but I learned some good values. But maybe it was more my parents than the church, but the church taught them too. But, you know, how this whole war thing, and, well, you know, like, you pray to God, and the other side prays to God, and this is supposed to be the same God, and, you know, it just makes no sense. Like the Pope in the Second World War supposedly blessed both sides, and...
From what I read, of course, I haven't attended personally, so I don't know what's being said, but there are a lot of churches that are very pro-war advocates.
Yeah.
And they say that, you know, we need, and of course, a lot of this war within the Middle East is, and now with ISIS, is being framed as it was in the 12th and 13th century as a crusade.
Yeah.
It's us, Christians, the bearers of the true word of God, Christ, versus these filthy animals who want to blow us up with their suicide bombers. Well, you know, that characterization, number one, is cartoonish and insulting at best.
Yeah.
I traveled through and I lived in Muslim countries. And they're just, again, you know, they have a different belief system, but they are not bent on destroying no. the Christian world.
No, no. Well, that would make sense because Muslims give so much honor and love and respect to Jesus that, I mean, he's one of the great prophets, according
to
them.
Yeah, they don't see him as the Son of God.
They're not Christians. That is something that our government, the U.S. government, and, well, a lot of Western governments, I think, and the media has tried. This is one of the ways they try to divide people using religion. So.
And get people fired up about the idea of war, and second, dehumanizing these people.
Yeah.
So everybody sees them as something less than human, and therefore, well, why not exterminate them? I mean, they're somewhere between human and insect, so we can just kill them all. And I point out, I've learned some things just myself recently that are actually public knowledge, but they're things that you don't focus on, that we actually, the sanctions under Bill Clinton between the first Iraq war and the second Iraq war killed 500,000 children, not adults. And there's an interview, and again, not a secret. This is on 60 Minutes, folks. This is not like some underground YouTube video. This is Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes admitting, yes, we did. We were responsible for the death of 500,000 children, and we thought it was worth the price.
It was worth it. Yes, I must say. Honestly, can you imagine a person saying that, thinking that?
And in my latest blog, I say to people, you know, most Americans are conscious. They're in possession of their senses. How can you rectify this in your mind? How can you be a Christian? How can you believe in spreading the supposed values of our country, which is freedom and democracy and all these wonderful things? How can you rectify that with the slaughter of 500,000 children? These are not political. These are not suicide bombers. They're kids. You know?
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I was thinking today, either I've lost my mind or a lot of Americans have lost their mind. It's got to be one or the other, because this stuff does bother me, you know.
I don't think that they've lost. They're just refusing. It's so much easier, I guess, for them to just sit there and watch the stupid TV shows and just veg out, dumb me down, you know, the couch potato thing. Come home from work, that's it. Because so many people still feel powerless. Occupy did empower a lot of people, but many people just still feel powerless. And so it's like subconsciously they understand that if they admit that something is wrong, that in all good conscience, one of your words, they would have to do something about it. And they are too powerless.
So it's easier just to deny.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like saying, no, Daddy is not an alcoholic. I mean, yeah, he drinks two cases of beer a night, but he's not an alcoholic, so we're not going to worry about it.
Right. And that's what it is. It's just that whole head in the sand thing, which is really an unattractive pose. So
I'm trying to figure out if I'm being an alarmist or if it's really come to a point now where it can't be ignored anymore. I mean, we're confronting, I guess, you know, the phrase is a perfect storm, which is really a beautiful kind of phraseology for the worst of all possible worlds. You've got climate change.
Right.
You've got potential nuclear war. You know, I talk about this on Facebook and on my website, and people go, oh, come on, you know, nuclear war. But we are now sticking our finger in the eye of Russia. We actually were working with Russia and Putin on some things, but now we are confronting them.
Yes, yes.
And they, believe me, Russia is not Iraq, and it's not Guatemala. this is not a country you want to be screwing around with.
Exactly.
They have their own sense of destiny. They have their own national pride. They have their own priorities, which is, you know, to promote a good life in Russia. They're not up to some evil plan. They just want to have a good life. They want their share of the big international pie, the wealth of the world. They want to participate in that. We're now provoking them, and from things I read, it looks like we actually want to go to war with them.
Because the people who are in charge, I mean, they know the buttons to push, and so of course, like getting out the legal president of the Ukraine and putting in a U.S. puppet was just flaunting that they could do it to Russia, and now I see that the U.S. is giving that puppet president $53 million, which, you know, to me that's a lot of money, but it's nothing. You know, it means nothing to the U.S. But so it's not the money. It's just the idea that they're flaunting, that they're giving him money to do whatever. So that kind of stuff. It's just like rubbing Russia's nose in things.
So right now, eastern Ukraine has been under assault by the Kiev government. They were beating the government back. They were whipping the official army of Ukraine, but now there's a ceasefire in place, and they've agreed to stop the fighting. They've agreed that that area of Ukraine, which is predominantly Russian, native Russian people, and was a part of the Russian Empire going back before even America was a country.
Right.
That has a certain amount of autonomy. It's not an independent country, but it has a certain amount of autonomy, which is all they were asking for before all this fighting started.
Exactly.
That is in place. Now, the American people, I know this probably is very complex for people, but people need to ask themselves questions. Why is it, if this thing is heading toward a peaceful resolution, why are we still putting sanctions on Russia? What are we doing trying to cripple their economy, to limit their ability to participate in the international banking system? What are we doing? What is the agenda? If the situation is being resolved, why are we still attacking Russia with sanctions?
Right. Well, then also, why do we have all of these bases, military bases, all around, surrounding Russia, missiles pointing that way? Why do we have all of that?
So if I say something on my blog, usually I try to phrase it in a way so that I don't sound like a complete lunatic. If I say something like, if you look at the situation objectively, if you look at it from the standpoint of Russians, it looks like America is attempting to set up a military situation to attack Russia. That's what it looks like. I mean, there's no reason to put bases.
I mean, how else would you interpret that?
Well, I don't know. How do people interpret that? There's no need for it. The only reason why you would put anti-ballistic missiles on their border is if you plan on attacking them and you want to keep them from retaliating. So this is kind of very provocative behavior on the part of America. This is what I was saying. Am I being an alarmist?
Well,
you know, people have been saying, yeah, the world's going to end. We're going to have nuclear war for many decades. But I'm wondering if we're actually getting to that point now.
Well, somebody has said it better than I, but they said that there's never been a time when we as a country went somewhere to or got like weapons and didn't use them. We always have things ready to go. And, you know, if you give somebody whatever, they're going to use it. Very few things are just going to sit on the shelf. So as far as these missiles, I hope not. I would hope that it's just just, I don't like that word in this context, but to scare. But why else? No, they want to really pretty much take out Russia. There's a lot of natural resources in Russia.
Oh, yeah. Very rich country.
And we know that the multinationals that pretty much rule the world have no boundaries. They don't care what country they take out or destroy, as long as they can get their hands on the resources.
And they don't care. They don't care how many innocent people they
Absolutely
kill.
Not. I mean, people are numbers. People are not human to them. So that makes no. It's just numbers. They're just to be used and discarded. It makes no difference.
So if, as I believe, and obviously you believe, this agenda is being driven by multinational corporations, I say it's time for America to take their country back. You know, these decisions are not being made by the American people are basically good, peaceful people. And we do not want more war, and yet we are setting up the conditions for a major confrontation with Russia, with China, and with Iran. And now it's interesting, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa have now banded together. So it looks on all fronts like we are trying to militarily confront this block of countries which threatens our economic rule of the world. That's what it looks like to me.
Yes, I totally agree.
So how do you get Americans to say, well, you know, this is, you know, up until now I've never wanted to be involved in politics, but since the future of the human race is at stake, maybe I need to shut off my TV and get out in the streets and say something. You know, think about this. Think about this.
Yeah.
When in your lifetime have you heard so little from the peace movement in America? You don't hear anything.
No.
You don't see anything. You don't see people in the streets. You don't see demonstrations. Nothing anymore. That's shocking to me.
We did see some of that, and I think that really was what kept us before. Now, going to try to wipe out Syria again by the back door. But, you know, a couple of years ago, when people, even small towns, were putting banners up, no war with Syria, all of that kind of thing. Maybe not quite a couple of years ago, no. But now, you know, they're trying to do the back door because the U.S. funded ISIS, the U.S. Yep. other countries funded ISIS, and now they're going to go in there and wipe out ISIS because they're trying to take over Syria and destroy it. So,
and that's all part of a larger agenda. I'm sure you're familiar with the Project for New American Century, neocons. It's all part of this agenda. You know, regardless of what you think of Obama, why is he buying into this? I don't understand. He's a man who's very, I think he's a very vain man. He's very narcissistic.
Oh, yes.
But as a narcissistic man, does he really want himself to be written in the history books as the man who started World War III?
We know he's bought and he was selected and blah, blah. But no, I think you're right as far as being very vain. I don't think he's thought about that. I think that somehow he's turned things around in his head a lot. So he isn't looking at himself in the history books as the man who started World War III, but more about, and he won't admit that he's the man who has done all this for the corporations. So he has to use words like democracy, you know, democracy with a gun kind of thing.
So does he view himself as like the great American conqueror, the man who finally put the rest of the world in their place? I don't.
The black man who, you know, he took America by storm and straightened out the whole world. Yeah, right.
That's an interesting.
What a mess. What a mess he is. And what a mess this country is for letting him be selected as president. Not that the other would have been better. I mean, it's so it's so bizarre that we do have good people who run for office, but it seems like by the time they get to a certain point, nah. Now, I've been very pleasantly surprised. Three congressmen are trying to make the moves to get this country to stop funding Israel.
Wow.
And I called all the offices. Very nice people in there said, oh, yeah, we'll make sure, you know, you get the message, putting this out. And then it's like, call your congressman, too. But there's three, two men and a woman who have started this move. And so we do still have some people in office who take the job seriously, and they're trying to represent the people who put them in office.
Yes.
I mean, so there are some, but there's so many who have just been bought off. Let's get real.
I mean, to me, every community, which means, you know, every congressional district and every senatorial, every state, people need to just look objectively at who they are sending to Washington, D.C., and say, is this guy voting the way I want him to vote, or him or her, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if they're not, out they go. I don't care how pretty their ads are or how great they look in a suit and tie or, you know, a business suit. It doesn't matter. What matters is how honestly and how loyally they represent the interests of their constituents.
Well,
you know,
there's I'm one of the people, and I've talked to some other people that really like the idea of contracts. When somebody is elected to office, there's a contract, and on it is everything that they said they would do.
Where is this? Where did this idea come from?
I do not know. I can't. I was just, when I was going to mention it, it's like, where did this come from? But
Ruth Ann, it's the premise of my book.
Because
it's the premise of the book.
Well, maybe then, okay, because I've talked to some other people about it. But
well,
maybe
good.
Then it came from, yeah, because if they
don't. I just want people to buy this idea. It's a great idea, and I can't get anybody to listen to me.
But it's perfect, because any other job you have, if you sign a contract, you don't live up to it, they don't wait until the next 3 years down the road to get rid of you. It's like, you didn't live up to it, you're gone. And that's what we need. Talk about your books, because we've only got 12 minutes, and I really want to get into, you've got a trilogy, The Man Who Loved Too Much.
Yeah, that's totally non-political. It's just, it's frivolous, it's fun, it's goofy, it's just entertaining reading. I'm so tired of writing political books and people saying, what, do you hate America, or what's your problem? But the last book, and I'm glad we're getting into this. I'm not trying to sell books, but I am trying to sell this idea. Folks, if you don't even read the whole book, just look at the book, borrow it from your neighbor or whatever, and read from page 56 to page 82. In that section, I explain the whole concept of candidate contracts, how you set it up within your own congressional district, so that they're a powerful tool for taking on big money politics. That's exactly what the book is about, an unlikely truth. And the unlikely truth is that my candidate, Martin Ruth, will get elected. But it's also an unlikely truth that America will take its democracy back. So the title is a kind of a play on words. But it still can be done. There's a workaround for all the big money politics. There's a workaround from Citizens United. But it takes people that are concerned, that are angry, that are fed up with the way that politics has been completely dominated by advertising and big money and so forth. And it said these people need to get together and talk about and make a contract with your whoever's running for office. And I'll tell you what, most of the people that are in office right now, most of the incumbents cannot sign this contract.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
In the contract, it says if they violate the terms, they are subject to a massive civil class action lawsuit by their constituents. So these guys can't sign it. So you find somebody like they do in Finland. You know, the people that go to the legislature in Finland are not professional politicians and lawyers. They're teachers and they're truck drivers and they're the guy down the street that runs, you know, that works at the grocery store. And they hold their jobs for them. And when they come back from the legislature, they still have their job and they've done something to serve their country. Find somebody in your community who's smart, who understands the issues, and who will sign the contract. They will protect Social Security. They will raise the minimum wage. They will stop the wars. They'll start cutting back on all this wasteful military spending. They'll close these hundreds and hundreds of bases America has all over the world. Find someone that will sign that contract and elect them. That's the answer.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. That was funny. I'm so sorry that I didn't recognize that came from the book, because it's like, it's such a wonderful idea. And okay, yes. And that is from the book An Unlikely Truth.
Yes.
Anyway. And because you have so many, you have like 8 full-length novels.
I do.
My goodness. And all of this has been since 2006?
Yes. Well, actually, since 2008 is when I started writing. You know what I'm trying to do right now is I'm trying to get Hollywood interested in making a movie of An Unlikely Truth. I figure, well, people don't have time to read, but they have time to watch a movie. So that's what I've been spending my last 2 months on, is talking to producers and production companies and so forth, which is not a lot of fun, because the first question is, you know, what, there's no zombies in this movie? Or where's the car chase? or who are we going to bomb in this movie? There's actually an interesting passage in An Unlikely Truth about drones, because the book is set in Dayton, Ohio, and in Dayton, Ohio, you have Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Yes. And as part of this, what happens during the campaign, one of the things that happens is that one of these drones, and they build and develop and test a lot of drones there. One of these drones goes out of control and crashes into a schoolyard in Dayton's suburbs and kills a little girl. And the government, of course, comes out and says, this is really a tragic thing, and we, you know, our hearts go out to the family, but this is what we need to do in order to win the war on terror. And my candidate says, wait a minute, this wasn't a weapon for using overseas. This was a domestic spying drone. This is a drone developed for use within the borders of the U.S. to spy on its own citizens. And he calls out the incumbent on this, and he achieves a certain level of national fame by taking this very courageous stand and saying, the President of the United States and your incumbent have lied to you. And this is one of the things that helps, you know, foster his eventual success. But in the book, as we said, is the strategy. And that the strategy is the key thing. Strategy allows a candidate to actually get some sort of foothold in a system that is dominated by two faces of the same party.
Exactly. The uniparty. Yeah.
The uniparty. Sounds nice. Uniparty.
Yeah, that's what I call it. And people say, oh, no, they're not the same. It's like, well, they may have a few differences, but yeah, they're pretty much the same.
Well, I think there are significant differences on social issues.
Yeah, but when you get down to it, they're both ruled by money, and they're both very capitalistic, and that's not a good thing at this point in the world's history. It's just not. So I don't know, but you do have some answers, John, and getting them out there is it. I hope that this works out with Hollywood. And when you do, don't let anybody rearrange your story. You be the screenwriter.
I'll do my best.
You know, because otherwise it would possibly and very frequently turn out to be something totally different and not make your point. I mean, they, from what I've heard, they have a way of doing that kind of thing. So,
well, you know, they're interested in box office sales.
Exactly.
But you know, what I'm saying to these guys is, hold on here. You know, Fahrenheit 9/11 costs $6 million to make. Now, it's not a fictional story, but it's about politics. It's about the political environment. It's about
right.
what's going on. You know how much money that film made? It brought in $110 million at the box office. You know, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth only cost a few million to make, $49 million. I say there is a market because you know what? People
yes.
are frustrated. They're angry. They want a positive narrative. They want to know that they actually have the power.
Yes, yes. Something to help. Just, I mean, people need to be empowered, however that comes. That it's important now more than ever.
So if there's any producers listening to this,
there we go.
Give me a call.
Get in touch with John.
We'll
once more, www.jdrachel.com.
That's it.
Yes, and you can catch up on the blogs we were talking about. The
blogs are a section called Slow Bullets.
Yes.
There's a little menu at the top, and
yes.
you know, you've got An Unlikely Truth, and you've got my books and my horrible poems. And,
they were published.
I know, but I don't know why. I hate poetry. I hate it.
But you write songs. I mean, you've been a musician forever. That's what you're talking about. You produce music, and so from writing songs to poetry, the two seem so connected to me.
They are, but you know what? You know why I hate it? Because writing good poetry is so difficult. It looks easy, but it's not. It's really not. So I guess I hate it because it kind of it's such hard work. You know, writing a song to me is easy. I'm working on a song called Island of Heiwa right now, which is this paradise where people live in peace. And they've thrown off the shackles of materialism, and they just live, and they enjoy the sunset, and they play with their kids. So I'm writing a song. That's easy for me to write, but writing good poetry is hard. So my respect goes out to any poets that are listening. I'll tell you, I'm in awe.
Yeah, I know a few poets, and I know a few that do like performance poetry. And
yeah.
That really, they get really worked up on that, and I like that.
That's fun. Yeah, the whole poetry slam thing is amazing. Now you're making me want to come back there.
See? Japan has lots of rice and lots of good veggies and beautiful mountains with snow and everything. But, you know, the U.S. still has some things. Well, you do come back and visit, though. So.
Yeah. America's a very amazing country in every respect.
Yes, it is. And people here, truly, there's wonderful people here, just like around the world. And many of us do not support our government and what it does. We've only got 1 minute left. John, it always goes fast. What's your last words of wisdom?
My last words of wisdom is keep the faith and love those who are important to you. Always share your love like you're not going to ever see them again, because every moment on our planet, especially with those people that you're close to, is important. You know, never take anybody for granted.
Right. And tell them you love them. Don't just show them. I mean,
yeah.
Show them, but tell them. The words are important, too. I mean, actions are very important. But it's nice just to say, I love them.
Yes.
It's good. Let them know what they mean to you. It's much better than the eulogy at somebody's funeral. I mean, you know, like,
come on. Hear that.
Now, give the flowers now.
Yeah, I had to die to get people to say nice things about
really?
Me.
Really? So let's
That's
give it
fair.
Now. Yeah. So John,
anyway, it's always a pleasure talking to you, Ruth Ann.
As
thank you.
Always. Thank you so much. I always love it, and it always just goes fast.
Okay.
So we'll do it again.
I hope so. Be good.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.